Hi, Alex.
Hey, Adam.
And hello, everyone.
Hey.
Welcome back to Liver Talks. This is episode 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. Later on in the program, we're going to be interviewing Dr. Oren Fix about the hepatology workforce study that was published in Hepatology back in June. But until then, we're going to talk about our plans for the podcast coming up with the liver meeting approaching quickly.
Yeah. So we'll keep this first segment short. We really think this is a great interview, so please stay around for it. Anybody who's listening to this podcast will be interested in what we talk about, which is the future of hepatology and hepatology training. So one can scarcely think of something that would be more pertinent to our listenership.
Perhaps even if you're a Russian bot.
Do the Russian bots listen to podcasts or just rank and review?
That's a good question. I don't know.
So Adam and I both love the liver meeting. We frequently discuss our fond memories, including last year in Boston and then a few years ago in DC as well.
What a year.
What a year. And while the meeting is going to be virtual this year, we still think there's a lot to be excited about for it. And one of the things that hopefully you will be excited about is that we want to have podcasts much shorter than these ones where we interact with some of the people that presented their research that day. And part of it, we'll be talking about the research itself, although presumably by virtue of the fact that you will be at the meeting, you'll hear a little bit about the research. But we also want to get into the process of conducting the research and what else interests each of those researchers. And so it should be a slightly different perspective. It'll be highly interactive with some of our thought leaders, as well as some of the trainees that are doing cutting edge research as well. And we're really excited to bring a new sort of spin to part of the liver meeting and do it with all of you. If you have any thoughts about people that might be good for it or want to participate yourself, please feel free to reach out to us.
Yeah, please do. Please reach out to us. We're really excited about being able to do hopefully daily podcasts, hopefully have some good guests, hopefully have a good time, relive the magic of the in-person liver meeting. And when we come back, we'll have our interview with Dr. Oren Fix. Stay tuned, everyone.
Stay tuned.
So we are now joined by Dr. Oren Fix, a transplant hepatologist and medical director of the liver transplant program at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle. He's also the co-author of Modeling the Hepatology Workforce in the United States, a Predicted Critical Shortage, a paper published in Hepatology this past June. The study aimed to model future demands for hepatologists while also reflecting on the current state of affairs through a survey of practicing liver specialists who are also ASLD members. Dr. Fix, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you guys very much for inviting me. This is really exciting.
So before we get into the paper, I wanted to see if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your current practice as a hepatologist, and also your role in ASLD.
Sure. So as you said at the top, I'm the medical director of liver transplant at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, and I'm a practicing transplant hepatologist. And in ASLD, I've had a variety of leadership roles, currently on the nominating committee and on the online learning committee, but I've been chair of a couple of committees, the training and workforce committee and the MOC committee. And I've been a committee member on other committees and been involved in a lot of different initiatives. So we'll talk a lot about the workforce study, of course, the pilot program, you know, things that are related to education, training, and workforce and hepatology.
Great. Yeah. So we definitely want to spend a good chunk of time talking about the article that you co-authored that was published in Hepatology, like I said, back in June, addressing an impending national workforce shortage in hepatologists. For our listeners who haven't had a chance to read the article, we'll link to it in the show notes. It'll be available on the website. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of what motivates the group to do a study like this and how it kind of informs practice and how it informs, you know, different initiatives that ASLD might take and how it might affect people in hepatology practice at present?
I hope you're ready for that very compound question.
I think you set it up quite well because, you know, there's been a general perception for years that there's a hepatology workforce deficiency, and that's been sort of furthering a lot of ASLD programs. So the Emerging Liver Scholars Program is one example where ASLD is funding and trying to attract residents into the field of hepatology, getting them mentorship, getting them to the liver meeting. There's also the pilot program, which is training third-year GI fellows in transplant hepatology, giving them the opportunity to be certified in hepatology with 3 years of training instead of the traditional 4 years of training. That's now a formalized, approved dual certification pathway. So those are just two examples of things that ASLD has done to grow the workforce in hepatology, all with this perception that there's a deficiency, but without really any data. So we thought it was time to really gather the data. The last workforce study was almost 20 years ago. It didn't really model the workforce. It just established the need for a new specialty in transplant hepatology. And so we thought it was time to find the data to see, are we really training enough hepatologists? Or are we not training enough hepatologists?
I think the paper speaks for itself in terms of making it pretty clear that the number of people with liver disease is going to increase. And by virtue of that, there's sort of a clear conclusion that we will need more people that are qualified to treat people with liver disease. How much of that do you see as being the role of people with advanced training in hepatology / transplant hepatology fellowships versus either beefing up some degree of the actual GI fellowship so that everybody coming out of GI fellowship at least feels comfortable with some degree of liver disease and management, and how much of that may fall on not GI doctors? So where we did residency, hep C treatment was actually in the primary care clinic and not in a hepatology clinic at all. How do you sort of see this being an issue that needs to be specifically addressed by trained hepatologists versus by providers writ large?
Yeah, it's a good point, because our workforce study showed that the majority of the hepatology workforce is made up of gastroenterologists taking care of patients with liver disease. And, you know, we recognize that liver disease is part of the training of a general gastroenterologist. It's part of the competence. And we don't want to take that away from gastroenterologists. We can't meet the demand if we decouple hepatology training from gastroenterology. We're still going to rely on that. It's also clear that we're not going to meet the demand just by training more hepatologists. So we need other strategies besides, for example, the pilot program that I just mentioned. We need more than just attracting more residents into GI and eventually hepatology. But I also think it's important to note that the need in the community and the need in academic centers and transplant centers is a lot more than what a general gastroenterologist is trained to do. And let's face it, it's a lot more than what a general gastroenterologist wants to do. Most gastroenterologists don't want to manage liver disease. It's either not, their strong suit, or they're not interested, or it's not leading to, procedures, which is where they're focused. Variety of reasons where we really want people who are really interested and specially trained in hepatology to take on the majority of the advanced cases. That's not all the hepatology need that's out there. You mentioned hepatitis C. Hepatitis C treatment is frankly easy now. It doesn't need to be relegated to hepatology alone. It doesn't require an advanced trained hepatologist to manage. That's probably still where a lot of the hepatology treatment is, but there's going to be a lot more therapeutics coming out that are going to require advanced training, treatments in NASH, treatments in fibrosis, and we're going to need more specialized clinics and more specialized hepatologists to be able to do that. I also want to mention that in addition to having gastroenterologists managing the workforce, trained hepatologists managing the workforce, we also need a lot of advanced practice providers, so nurse practitioners, physician assistants. They are a very important part of how we care for hepatologists. And they're not really differentiated when they come out of training like physicians are. And so it's really hard to sort of recruit them into hepatology. They may not be members of ASLD. They may not have already been trained or working in a GI or hepatology environment. And those are people that we really need to target to meet this the demand and need.
Sure. The survey component of the paper sort of outlines the concerns of the respondents in terms of, their hangups and with regard to entering hepatology as a field, being one, the extra year of training, which has obviously been addressed by the 3-year training program, as well as compensation, which I think is a difficult thing to be able to address as a profession without, large changes that could conceivably be outside of our control as well. I was wondering if there are any other major strategies that we should be thinking about to attract, more learners into the field of hepatology that might be more low-hanging fruit or more attainable.
Yeah, I think you've covered a couple of things. I think the compensation is still quite good, especially if you're in a transplant program and you're part of a GI division.
That's good, Alex.
Yeah, great to hear. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
It's a bit of a struggle. You know, I'll be honest. My personal experience has been it's a bit of a struggle to justify the compensation when you're not doing as many procedures as your GI colleagues. But I do think that being part of a transplant program helps. Being part of a GI division where your colleagues recognize your expertise and the way that you complement their work. It's a little bit harder in a healthcare system where you may not be part of a transplant program or you're not doing a lot of endoscopy. And maybe that's appropriate. You know, maybe the compensation there is appropriately lower. But I also think, you know, it's important that people that are interested in hepatology recognize that hepatology is not all transplant. I know we're going to get into this, but I think the name of the specialty, transplant hepatology, has been a bit of a disservice to our specialty, because there are plenty of people out there who want to be hepatologists, who want to focus their career in hepatology, who are aware that hepatology is part of gastroenterology training and don't want to do an extra year of training. It's just 1 year, but it's, that's a long road. When you get to that point, you're already 6 years out of medical school and another year is another year. So I think we need to, make it clear that hepatology is more than just transplant, that the training involved in that extra year, if that's how you choose to go about it, is helping you to be able to manage all aspects of liver disease. You really can't be, I think, a hepatologist without knowing what a patient going through transplant is experiencing. You need to be able to manage patients with cirrhosis, decompensated cirrhosis, who will need a transplant eventually. And, maybe you don't need to manage post-transplant patients, but that's an added skill that might help, boost your competency in the community and maybe even improve, your job prospects, for example. So I think that, there's a lot of things that we can do to attract people into hepatology. And one is recognizing there is a need for additional training beyond just general gastroenterology. And a transplant hepatology fellowship is not just transplant. Doesn't mean you have to practice in a transplant program. You have to practice in an academic environment. Really that has shifted quite a lot in the last 20 years. There are a lot more hepatologists practicing in health systems that don't have transplant or in the community.
I guess piggybacking on that, because you've alluded to it in the paper, talks about the idea of changing the name of fellowships from transplant hepatology fellowships to advanced hepatology fellowships. Beyond sort of changing a little bit of the mindset that you've described in terms of what should be expected and what you're coming out of an advanced fellowship knowing, do you think there's actual fundamental changes to what the training should entail to have this more broad-based thing, or is it more on the branding/mindset side?
I think it's a little bit of both. When the specialty started in 2006, the training and the ABIM certification exam were really focused on advanced hepatology and not just transplant, and that's shifted. So if you look at the program requirements and if you look at the ABIM certification exam blueprint, it's very much more focused on transplant medicine. So I do think that those aspects need to change. The ACGME requirements and the ABIM exam probably does need to change to reflect better what hepatologists do. But I actually think the training itself probably does not need to change all that much. I think that in general, when you do a transplant hepatology fellowship, you are learning advanced hepatology. You're not just learning transplant medicine. And I think the majority of programs probably don't need to change their curriculum all that much.
Yeah. One of the things I wonder too is, Alex and I went to a residency program that had a primary liver service team. And I know, anecdotally from our program, there's probably like six or seven people within, our year and the year above us who ended up going into hepatology because of that experience. And I wonder how much of a disservice, and it's obviously not the fault of the individual program, but how difficult it is for trainees who maybe don't have access to that kind of training during residency to really understand what hepatology is, whether it's transplant or advanced hepatology, and how you reach out to people. Because, you know, in my current institution, UCLA, there is no primary liver service. And so there's definitely a difference in how, at least from my perspective, how residents see hepatology as a specialty between the residents I encounter in fellowship compared to those that I encountered in residency.
Yeah, that's a good question, because, you know, the truth is that you really aren't going to go into a field unless you've been exposed to it, right? And mentorship is so important. I would not be a hepatologist today if it weren't for the people that I worked with somewhat randomly at first, and really looked up to. And so that's the kind of person I want to be. And when I eventually did a transplant hepatology rotation, which, by the way, my program, my GI program, did not have transplant either. I was not exposed to transplant until I sought it out myself, and I did an external rotation in transplant pathology, and that just changed my worldview. You know, to be able to see patients on death's door get a second chance at life was remarkable, and there was no going back at that point for me. But I think you're right. You know, if you're not exposed to it, then it's hard to imagine that that's the kind of doctor you want to be. So, you know, on the one hand, you know, some people are going to get lucky. They're going to get, you know, great mentors, or they're going to be put on a rotation where they see those kinds of, they have those kinds of experiences. On the other hand, people are going to have a sense that this is something they want to explore, and they're going to seek it out themselves. You know, in truth, you know, you might end up in a program that doesn't have transplant and never get exposed to it. And maybe there needs to be some way to go back and get the training that you need, which, you know, isn't really realistic to be able to do another year of training once you've already gotten out into practice. There really isn't a pathway for those people right now to get certified.
Yeah, I feel like everyone who goes into hepatology kind of has that story about, you know, when the light bulb came on for them, and you know, it's hard, I guess, to have that feeling when you're not experiencing it. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a little bit on ASLD as well. You know, how do we get these experiences out to people who are not members, who are not already practicing the field? Get to them early, you know, before they are differentiated. That's what the Emerging Liver Scholars Program really is all about. You know, getting people in their residency before they've really decided on a career.
Yeah, I did the Emerging Liver Scholars Program. I thought it was great at getting the message out. The IBD societies also do like some sort of like travel program where they will like sponsor someone from an institution that really isn't IBD heavy at an IBD heavy institution for a month if they have like elective time. There are definitely ways that I guess that could be achieved. Just kind of spitballing off the top of my head.
I think that idea would work really well for advanced practice providers also. You know, give them a chance to spend some time in a transplant program, see what it's about, get them some specialized training, create a curriculum, and grow the workforce in that way as well.
So for those who are considering a career in hepatology and are reading the study, what do you think, you know, the most important things for people on the trainee side should be? You know, what are the take-home points for those people?
I think, first of all, the point of the study is that there's already a significant workforce deficit. And in the next 10 or 15 years, that's just going to grow. We're talking over 2,000 FTEs that we need to sort of develop in some way in the next 10 or 15 years to meet what we expect to be a growing need. And that's despite, you know, being able to treat and cure almost everybody with hepatitis C. We're still seeing a growing need in liver disease with NASH, with HCC. We're also seeing a decrease in the workforce from primarily retiring physicians, but also changes in practice patterns, and the fact that we just can't meet the demand with 50 plus transplant pathology fellows per year. So I think this is a field with a great need. It's you know, frankly, job security, because there will be a job out there if that's the, you know, field that you choose. And, you know, I'll be honest, the jobs are not all in the places that everybody wants to be, right? It's you know, there are some places that are saturated, you know, metropolitan areas are saturated. That doesn't mean that those jobs don't come up, you know, pretty frequently. But there's going to be a job out there. And especially if you're interested in clinical hepatology, not necessarily in a transplant program, not necessarily in a big academic environment, you're going to have your choice of jobs. So that's one thing that I think people should take away from this, that this is a field that is going to have plenty of need and jobs. The other thing I think to note is what we've already talked about with the name change, you know, that transplant hepatology is not only transplant. I think, you know, we didn't really cover this a lot when we talked about the name, but the reason for the name was a little bit of acquiescence to the GI community to differentiate us from what a gastroenterologist does in liver disease. It was sort of to reassure the GI community that we are not separating from GI, that we are still part of GI, that hepatology is still a part of GI. And that remains to this day. Even with our distinct specialty, we're still, for the most part of GI, and the subspecialty, the training has to go through GI. And I don't think there's a huge appetite to change that right now. Certainly there's some talk about, you know, should hepatology be its own distinct specialty in internal medicine beyond GI? And I don't think that's a good idea for a lot of practical reasons. But I do think it's time that we change our name and change the curriculum to better reflect not only what we do already, but what the needs are for the community. And so I think it's important for those who are interested in a career in hepatology to see that there is a need for specialized training beyond just GI. That doesn't necessarily mean another year of training, as we've pointed out with the dual certification pathway, but it does require you to recognize what you're interested in, you know, right off the bat, so that you can tailor your training to meet your career goals.
As is discussed in the paper, there is an inherent difficulty in workforce-related papers in sort of predicting into the future. One of the many examples given was the fact that, you know, Hep C is now curable, whereas that was predicted to be one of the big sort of burdens moving forward into the time that we're living in now. And while stipulating that the future is unknown, with the exception of what we've already discussed in terms of some changes to fellowship training, what other changes do you think are either most achievable or the ones that you're most excited about to address this very likely impending shortage?
Well, I think, you know, on the need side, you know, in terms of the prevalence of liver disease, you know, that is changing rapidly. You mentioned hepatitis C. There's probably going to be huge changes in management of NASH very soon, and that could change the game. Same with HCC. So I think, you know, continuing the work to manage liver disease, you know, on that side is important, in addition to growing the workforce itself. You know, we've already mentioned, you know, making training a little bit more appealing in terms of reflecting what it really is, so that people know what they're getting themselves into. Shortening the training, bringing more advanced practice providers into the field, and giving them the specialized training that they need. Those are, I think, the main focuses right now. But you know, as you mentioned, the you know, there are big problems with doing workforce studies. It's a bunch of assumptions on top of assumptions, and those are going to change. And you know, we haven't done a workforce study in 20 years. And I think that's too long. You know, our assumptions are not going to be accurate probably in 5 years. And so we really need to continue to update these workforce studies to make sure that we're on the right track and that we're course correct.
Before we move into our lightning round, anything else about the paper that you wanted to address that maybe we didn't ask about that you think it's important that people know?
Well, I mostly want to just thank my co-authors, because this was not done just by me and certainly could not have been done by any one person. So if you don't mind, I'll just mention the primary author, Mark Russo.
Please.
Eamon Kotesh, Katie Duggan, who's an ASLD staff member who's been instrumental in making this happen. Marcia Dittmeyer was our modeling specialist that was hired by ASLD. She's done many workforce studies before. Michael Fuchs, Raymond Chung, and Gotham Reddy, the senior author. So, you know, without them, this project would not have been able to be done. So that's mainly what I wanted to do.
Yeah. And we've posted a link to the actual paper in our show notes. So everybody should check it out. It's a shockingly easy read and worthwhile for anybody who's taking 40 minutes to listen to us talk about liver disease. The reading the paper seems like a relatively low bar, so probably worth checking out.
Agreed.
All right. Well, it's time, as I'm sure you've been eagerly awaiting. It's time for the lightning round, where we ask you mostly questions that have nothing to do with hepatology. To get to know you a little better, we switch up the questions to some extent each time, but we have a few oldies but goodies from all of them. So, Adam, you want to start us off with the first?
Okay. Yeah. This is actually my favorite one that we've asked in every podcast, but can you name one time that luck factored significantly into your career trajectory?
Oh, absolutely. And I already alluded to this earlier. It's being paired with the right mentor. When I was in medical school, I just happened to have an elective clinical rotation with a hepatologist who was hysterical and brilliant and, you know, just an amazing role model. And he was the first person to inspire me to go into GI at first and then eventually hepatology. And then again, when I became a GI fellow, I mentioned I wasn't in a transplant program. I actually didn't think I was going to be a hepatologist at that point, but was randomly paired in a continuity clinic with a hepatologist and randomly paired initially with a research mentor who was a hepatologist. And so all of these three people were instrumental in shaping my career as a hepatologist. And those were not intentional pairings.
The next question, another one of our favorites, is what is your favorite liver cell and why?
Oh, wow. I guess the Kupffer cell, because, you know, they're elusive, right? Everybody knows what hepatocytes are and cholangiocytes are. And you know, the pathologists like to throw around what the Kupffer cells are doing and they think they can predict what happened before based on that. And I think they're just fascinating, elusive cells to me.
Shouts to the Kupffer cell.
yeah.
When is the last time you performed a colonoscopy?
Oh, it's probably been 3 or 4 years. Probably about 4 years. And you know, I'll be honest, it's not something I'm really proud of. I went into GI because I loved doing procedures and I didn't want to be a surgeon. That was kind of the logic there initially. I still love doing procedures and I miss it. It breaks up the monotony of clinic a little bit. You get to use a different skill set and I found it really fun to do, but as a hepatologist, at least in my center, we're separate from GI. So it's really hard to be doing, you know, general endoscopy. But I'd like to get back to it eventually.
One last one is, what's the last book you read or show or movie you watched?
Well, that's easy because, I have a newborn baby, and so I've been reading The Wonder Weeks.
Okay.
for any new parents or parents to be, I highly recommend it. It gives you a lot of insight into what your baby is going through and how to manage it and to realize that, you know, your baby is not abnormal. Just because it's always crying or always sleeping or always eating, all of that is normal. And I'm looking forward to the next, as they call it, leaps in the book. Where the baby acquires new skills and becomes more of a person.
Well, congratulations again.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for joining us to talk about the hepatology workforce, this paper, and hepatology profession as a whole. We really, really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you guys so much. This has been a real pleasure. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. I hope you all enjoyed that interview as much as we did and got some insights into the field that we're all interested in and excited about the fact that we will be in demand from a job perspective. That's always exciting. We thought for our freestyle segment. We'll get it down sometime. Freestyle segment, we would just do a quick one today and talk a little bit about our plans for voting for the upcoming election, because regardless of who you're voting for, it's important to have a plan in place for the election, which is on November 3rd. Adam, what's your plan?
I will be voting by mail. California's mailing all of its residents vote by mail ballots.
Yeah.
And then my fiance and I will be dropping our ballot off in person because of the issues with the mail.
Sure.
What about you?
So my fiance and I both voted by mail for the primary. Now that, as both of us have alluded to, I'm a second year fellow and functionally retired, I think we may get in on the early voting because I can go at sort of off hours where it won't be too crowded and take advantage of that. I'm in Massachusetts, as has been mentioned, and so early voting actually starts pretty soon, October 17th. And so you have a good 2-week chunk to sort of get it done. So I'm going to try to do that. Obviously, I also want to get the sticker. That's another perk. But obviously, vote by mail is very safe and efficacious. So I think that's a great option as you are doing.
I believe you do get a sticker if you vote by mail, because I got one. Good. I voted by mail in the primary, and I think they mail you the sticker because everyone is cognizant of the sticker.
Well, that's a huge relief. And then the only...
So for those of you voting for the sticker out there.
Yeah, if there's nothing else.
What's wrong with you, first of all?
And then the only other thing that one of the other things we have been doing is Vote Forward, which is pretty nonpartisan, but it just is handwritten letters to people that don't usually vote in elections in a variety of swing-ish states. And you just write to them saying why you're voting and when the election day is. So it's a fun thing to do if anybody is interested in something else or has missed out on the opportunity to have pen pals. Unidirectional pen pals, as it were, but pen pals.
Right. And make sure you have a plan to vote. And honestly, if you feel like your work demands are, for whatever reason, preventing you from working, work with your program leadership. I think that's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's not the case, but if it is, that's something that should be figured out.
Yeah. And if you want what voting options exist for you, regardless of what state you're in, votesaveamerica.com has everything for every state and is very easy to use. So it's a very good resource.
Next month, we'll be doing a reenactment of a bill on Capitol Hill as part of our freestyle PSA segment.
Yeah, we'll be back with something more fun next time. But in reality, what's more fun or important than voting? So really as good a use of the freestyle segment as any.
And we'll be back next time with a married Alex Vogel.
That's right. That God willing.
Well, it seems like everything's going to work out.
Yeah. If we're back next time and I'm not married, then we'll have a hell of a story for the freestyle
segment.
I'll
be back next time with a new co-host.
All right. But thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for more announcements as to our pods for the liver meeting, as mentioned in the first segment. But this should be a lot of fun. So thank you guys for sticking with us. If you haven't already, please subscribe. Smash the subscribe button.
Smash it.
And download the episode, listen, and then give us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you via Twitter, via email, via review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, Adam. Bye.